Hello, everyone. I'm here with Ian Flitcroft, and this is the first in a series of what I hope will be really engaging and really important podcasts talking about the International Myopia Institute publications. Now, they were just published very recently on the 28th of February, and Ian was the lead author and the committee leader of the definitions report. And so, Ian, I wanted to have a bit of a chat to you today about the definitions report, so particularly for our primarily clinical audience, to get a concept of what you think the key take-home messages will be. And we're here tonight in Brisbane. There's a little bit of background noise for set up for a dinner, and Ian's going to be talking all about this to a bunch of Brisbaneites shortly. But obviously, this is something that is important for us to understand and to take on board right across the world. So thanks very much, Ian, for being involved in this chat. And what I wanted to ask you first of all is, why do you think we need to define myopia? What do you think are the important aspects that we need to understand in defining myopia?
There's two main reasons, one of which is to eliminate a lot of historical baggage. There's so many definitions which the old theories are sort of wound into the terms. So part of it actually was cleaning things down to a very simple set of terms. But the really fundamental one is for evidence base, so that for going forward, for meta-analysis and for comparison, a lot of other areas that have had standardized classifications for definition, I always think of diabetes, clinically significant macular edema. That definition has transcended through trial after trial after trial and helped to find things. When you look at people's definitions of particularly at the higher end, there's a huge variation. So some of the analysis was just looking at that variation.
Mm.
There's no absolutely right answer, wrong answer to that, but at least if we can coalesce around some consensus that allows us to allow comparisons. People often get sort of more bothered about the higher one. Statistically, the lower one actually is more of a concern. Everyone says minus 0.5. And there's a lot of reference in there to selection bias, which may be regarded as slightly obscure. But the problem is, because of the way the distribution curve works, is if you take all myopes to minus 5, an awful lot of them in that small group, and some of those will be sort of just slightly myopic emmetropes biologically.
This
question of selection bias and trying to promote the concept of sensitivity analysis. So if you are, whatever threshold you're using, if you're using a different one to that, throw in an analysis which compares different thresholds. That means results will be there for meta-analysis.
Mm.
It'll also allow us to look for biases in that, in that sample.
Yeah.
So particularly in epidemiological studies, if you're including minus 0.5 rather than minus 1, you're looking at slightly different results. So that's important to get that standardized.
Yeah. So that's obviously important from a frequency, from an epidemiological point of view. What about the question of high myopia? Now, I want to digress just a tiny little bit. You're quite well known for making a very strong case that there's no physiological level of myopia. But the terminology of pathological myopia is something that was explored in the paper as well. So your paper you published in 2012 was talking about how even with low levels of myopia, there's increasing risk of pathology compared to the emmetrope. So therefore, it's not fair to call less than minus 5 physiological and more than minus 5 pathological. So how did you and your committee tackle that question of pathological and high myopia and that delineation?
So we got rid of physiological. So that's definitely not included.
Okay, it doesn't exist, guys. There's no such thing as physiological myopia.
And I lost the battle about physiologic with a whole bunch of retinal specialists who wanted a term. But if you look, the most important thing about that was the separation of pathologic as an umbrella term for the structural complications.
So if you
look within that, there's no, it doesn't actually refer to a threshold. Refractive threshold, there's exceptions to that, or an axial length. And the high myopia is purely refractive. So the problem in the past, people have used pathologic just to mean minus 6 without any problems. And someone who's minus 8 and 25, that kind of looks pretty good.
Yes.
35, thin, skinny.
Yeah.
45, serious trouble, 55, 65, that eye has changed.
Yes.
It's so that a refraction or an axial length without understanding that biological process doesn't make any sense. So pathological myopia is pathologic myopia, just to have a sort of single spelling, was the term the retinal people were quite keen to keep as an umbrella term. But it's clearly defined just to be a sort of container for a range of other conditions. Now, all these conditions are going to become very common. So actually it's really important that we do get defined terminology.
So in talking about the question of pathologic myopia, something that your paper deals with is grading scales, and in particular myopic macular degeneration or myopic maculopathy. We've got a little bit of ice cube noise in the background, so hopefully you guys can still hear us.
Just to prove we're in Brisbane. Yeah.
Yes, we need ice cubes here. So do we have an effective grading scale for myopic pathology? Or do we have it for particular conditions? And what should clinicians be aware of in terms of understanding these structural complications of myopia?
In terms of the ideal sort of outcome, the terminology was a little bit of a compromise because of previous WHO publications. And PMETA, which is this pathological, large consensus group, which defines a standard now. So within that condition, that is quite close to an international standard, as mentioned, for diabetes and everything else.
Yeah.
So photographic grading systems are just that. They're not. So you have the LOX grading system, which is useful for cataracts.
Mm.
It doesn't include the visual acuity, which you'd normally regard as an important part of clinical setting.
Yeah, you think so. Yeah.
So you don't need that. You have a photographic standard. The whole point is it allows interventions to be standardized and compared.
Yeah.
It's not, and it was never intended, it wasn't designed to be a comprehensive set of clinical tools.
Mm. Yeah.
Whole load of other imaging techniques which have become absolutely essential. I mean, high definition OCT is certainly got a huge amount of information, and choroidal structure. And also imaging of photoreceptors down to RPE layers. So we're going to have far more effective clinical tools. But that's for clinical management in terms of just a set of definitions. There are three thresholds there, one of which is from a WHO point of view, one definition, which is super simple and is designed for a RAB study, an RAAB, which is the Rapid Assessment of Avoidable Blindness.
Mm-hmm.
Stuff done with a retinoscope and a retinal thalmoscope.
Oh, wow.
You know, a long way from a long way from a plug.
Yeah.
So there's a limited functional assessment. It's sort of dirty, but, you know, it's an essential part of assessment. The next grade up is the PMETA, which is a photographic study, which is particularly would be good for natural history studies, for intervention studies, and over and above that, there are a set of definitions about some of the conditions, which just help to sort of standardize the terminology, but how that'll be monitored will really be sort of just part of the study design. You don't need ahead of time to define exactly how you measure a condition. You can, but no one's going to take any correct interest. And as soon as you do it, it's going to be out of date.
So I think that your paper makes a clear remit for the fact that we need to assess for these issues, that we have some classification and grading systems, the MetaPM analysis in particular you've mentioned, but that they don't necessarily bring in all aspects of all of the imaging that we have available at this point. What are the other non-macular complications of myopia that were key mentions in your report?
The new ones, it really is trying to bring in a wide range of conditions from particular retinal ischiasis and tractional macular hole within a single umbrella, which is MTM, which is myopic tractional maculopathy. And also in relation to the disc changes. We're all used to the sort of funny-looking myopic disc and association with glaucoma. But at this higher end, the structure of the optic nerve and the supporting sclera is so abnormal, they get an optic neuropathy, which is not correlated at all with interocular pressure.
Yeah.
So this isn't LTG. This is where the posterior structural changes are so severe they're actually directly affecting optic nerve function. So,
what is it called? Myopia-associated glaucoma-like optic neuropathy.
Can
we make an acronym out of that? M-A-G-L-O, McGlocken.
Yeah, no.
So can we talk for a moment about retinal detachment?
Mm-hmm.
So we generally believe that there's a higher risk of retinal detachment with higher levels of myopia, but because retinal detachment occurs in non-myopic situations, how did the committee deal with that as part of the continuum of myopia pathology?
So that it was in the same way that cataract, posterior sort of cataract, is a complication that occurs in people with myopia and people that don't have it. There's this more frequent in people with the risk is higher. Similarly with retinal detachment, even though there are distinctive features, particularly sort of early onset, sometimes more challenging surgery, it's not a uniquely myopic complication. So the thought process really is that if the complication is a direct consequence and uniquely myopic, then it falls within category that of pathology.
Yeah, yeah.
So even though the evidence relating to the risk profile of particularly very high myopes, because they're a reasonably rare beast, or at least they are presently, there's still plenty of hyperopes detachments. So just the standard sort of traumatic or PVD ones there, swing the number. So I'm very happy that it logically sits in the same bracket as a cataract related complication, just that the risk curve is much deeper.
Yeah.
So I think that's quite a natural fit. I have no personally, even though I had some battles about other things, that one, I think you all happily agree that that was the right point thing.
So I'm interested to ask you about whether the definition includes cycloplegia or not. And this is something which was an important factor in the clinical management guidelines. Not all optometrists out there have access to cycloplegia. And so from a clinical management point of view, this is important. From a clinical trials or a research point of view, we might expect that cycloplegia is a requirement. But I'm interested to hear how you and your committee decided on the definition of cycloplegia or not as part of that refractive definition.
Yeah, but this definition has to apply in all sorts of contexts. So if you look at a lot of papers in epidemiology of survey results from adult populations, some of them will be cycloplegia, some won't be. In clinical practice, if someone's refracted somebody and haven't used cycloplegia, are they not myopic? Obviously, they are myopic.
Yeah.
If there's a definition and there's a remuneration issue in relation to myopia and glasses, insurers could get wriggly about that. So if it's to define myopia in a practical and a research setting, saying when the accommodation is relaxed includes cycloplegia, but also means that you can't do it badly.
Yes, yeah. So that's an important factor, actually, is that the definition is when ocular accommodation is relaxed. So that allows for normal clinical techniques, which occur in practice, as well as cycloplegia, to ensure that we're reaching that definition.
Yeah, and allows. So you shouldn't have a definition which is so pure that it's only applicable for to research. And again, this is a question of where's that sort of detail best placed? Is that best placed within a research protocol or a definition? Research protocol.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's the place for the technique, and there's no reason not to do that. Omitting a reference to the fact that it should be relaxed would be remiss in the sense that it means that there's a minimum standard to ensure that you are measuring what you should be doing. It's also discussed in relation that young adults or kids are involved, that cycloplegia obviously is a strongly recommended intervention.
Yeah.
But adult population surveys, clinical techniques are.
Yeah, it may not be
evolved
necessary
over hundreds of years to be able to measure that.
Absolutely. On some level, we've got to be trusted to do the job right, but it's important to also have definitions that encompass a variety of different levels of evidence.
But if you're using a definition within a study, then it's almost inevitable that it, if the age profile indicates, that's going to be.
Yes. Yeah.
So, but we're not. It's not. The idea is to be sort of technique agnostic.
Yes.
So, and yeah. So it was also, if the nurses doesn't, sometimes things like objective are thrown in.
Yes. Yeah.
So, whereas, okay, so if you do a subjective, is that, is that not a myopic, measurement?
Mm. So obviously objective techniques could be very important from that research study point of view, but if we've got a whole enormous amount of epidemiological data, that may not be as pure in terms of being able to garner that information.
So there's no reason to include that. And where the need is there, it should be included.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And one of the get out clauses in the paper, obviously, is that if you get a small number of people try to put something together, and no matter how much sort of broader consultation there is, those people are going to disagree with you.
But just
making an appeal that where non-standard terms are used, they're just clearly defined. The problem is an awful lot of times the terms are just thrown in there, and the person who uses them knows what they mean, but it's the same term used in multiple ways. And pathological myopia as a refractive threshold is exactly that.
Yeah.
It was used for sort of all sorts of things. There are papers that -4 in a child is pathological because it was unusual. It gets kind of seriously unhelpful.
That could be unusual in a 4-year-old, but not necessarily unusual in a population of 12-year-olds.
So the key separation was to entirely divorce that pathologic concept from refractive threshold. Yeah. So refractive thresholds are quantitative. Clear and simple.
So from your analysis of the research and in writing this paper, did you find, or was it appropriate at all to make an axial length delineation of pathologic? I know you said earlier that pathologic could be independent of refraction and independent of axial length, but we've talked about how it was defined by refraction. What do you say about definition by axial length?
Because wherever the threshold you try to be, there are examples.
Pros and cons.
There are counterexamples. You'll see staphylomas in short eyes.
Mm.
So that's a function of how thin the posterior started and various other genetic factors.
Yeah.
So Kyoko Onematsui, who sort of was a real driving force in that, and she took over a clinic in Tokyo Dental by Takeshi Takoro, who had recorded and monitored these high myopes over decades. The most extraordinary sort of database. Most of it's not published. It was published in one very hard to find book, which I have and will lend to nobody for ever losing it. So she's sitting on this enormous sort of historical sort of database of information. She was a real sort of source of information about all those exceptions. So she was probably the one who would care most about that, and she was the one who was most clear cut that axial length obviously is a correlate. But we can define this is a set of structural complications.
Yeah.
So they're defined by those structural changes.
Yeah, and that could be independent of axial length. So obviously we've still got that risk factor there, but we do have to be concerned about these structural complications regardless of axial length, and more so as we get into higher levels of myopia.
Yeah, you can axial length. So the paper on axial and refractive risk factors of uncorrected visual loss in European from Karen Klaver's group, that Rotterdam study, was kind of the way to go. So you can see that risk profile.
That was 26 millimetres people, 26 millimetres.
In relation to, and I'll be spending some of this today about the difference between individual risk and population risk, but the also in terms of the, where the inflection point on individual risk comes in terms of refraction, that also, helped to delineate that. 6 is more relevant.
Yeah.
Obviously, the Brian Holden sort of paper was on 5, which will produce higher level of high myopes than that threshold.
Yeah.
It's not that hard to actually just what that is, but it's sort of, you know, it's not an insubstantial reduction. But the logic of that paper was being a global paper that's on a global setting, a high proportion of myopes haven't got access to visual correction.
Mm.
So if you are -5, you reach the WHO definition of legal blindness.
Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah.
So there's a perfectly good rationale for that.
Yes.
That's a situation whereby if you're publishing papers around that, you can publish a sensitivity analysis. So probably for that paper, it'll probably be worth some point doing sensitivity analysis showing what the differences are at the different threshold.
Yeah.
Just to allow that comparison. But
yeah.
So if you want to publish a paper at 5 and you just published within the analysis, did that sensitivity analysis, it's not hard to do, the data's all there.
Mm.
It provides a lot more understanding about the question, and also automatically enhances the value of comparison. So I don't think it's any great sex appeal in sensitivity analysis, but it's incredibly valuable.
Yeah. Scientific necessity. Mm. So this is the projection of global myopia hitting 50% by 2050 that we're discussing.
-5. So because the 50% was at the low threshold. So that's all myopia.
Okay.
So the only impact is on the high myopia numbers.
Okay.
So
sure.
So the myopia was everybody more myopic than -0.5. So that doesn't matter.
Oh, okay.
So the headline figure is unchanged. It's the absolute numbers for the high myopes will be slightly different. But they've also then published an association between refractive and risk model, which actually is just related to the continuous refractive error. So actually, if you go back to risk level, it actually comes out in the wash.
But,
the core numbers just of high myopia will be different from that.
Mm.
But there's enough analysis there in relation to risk for you to work that one out.
Okay. And I just wanted to ask you about pre-myopia. So in the Myopia Profile Facebook group, there was some heated debate recently about whether pre-myopia was a true entity or whether it's something made up by the evangelists and it wasn't actually a thing. And if we call every child a pre-myope, then they're satisfying the definition. But I was really interested to see that in your paper that pre-myopia has achieved a definition. So it's a distinct entity and not an evangelistic fiction as such. So can you tell us a bit about pre-myopia?
Yeah, well, it's now an evangelistic fact. If I think anyone don't believe it, I just say one word, Arinda.
Yeah.
So in that, the longitudinal surveys of when you look at what's happening to eye growth, showing that 3 years prior to becoming myopic, the people who end up being myopic started showing a different accelerated growth pattern. Normally growth is continuing decelerating.
Yeah.
There's an acceleration of that happened before myopic. And that's not just in Arinda. So
it's been found in the CLEAR study as well. So the fastest progression of myopia
did I get the wrong way around? I think I did.
Yeah. Look, it's been proven, guys. It's been proven. Pre-myopia is a thing.
Thank you, Kate. It is a clear one. there's something that Jane Griasdi called the knee, and Mantiavi has sort of all sorts of papers showing this in longitudinal studies. When you follow kids through, the fastest rate of change is often in the year before they become
myopic. Absolutely.
So that clinical change. So there's a biological trigger which produces that change. Now, the proof of the pudding's in the eating, so that for pre-myopia to be a valid concept, within that definition, that even though it sounds a bit woolly, it's where there are enough risk factors to produce a probability of myopia.
So our key risk factor is refractive, being not as hyperopic as the child should be. We also have other risk factors in terms of visual environment that we understand and family history as well that are risk factors in pre-myopia.
But if you look at the latest CREAM paper, which was primarily about different visual mechanisms, and it's a great paper, but buried in that, there was one figure which gene prediction for myopia
is rubbish because it only explains tiny amount of variance.
Yeah, there's so many genes responsible, isn't there?
If you look at it from a as a decile, the highest decile, the top 10% in terms of risk profile, and look at the risk of high myopia within that group, it's enormous.
Yeah,
so being able to predict accurately across the population, it's not going to work. But that's not who we care about.
You know,
in pre-myopia, what we're trying to do, we're not trying to treat everybody. This isn't some creeping thing. The idea is to get the really bad ones into treatment as soon as you can. So actually, if pre-myopia is only used for the top 10-15%, that's what it's called.
We're going to capture more, aren't we?
So if there's an intervention, and obviously there are trials now looking at, you know, pharmacological pre-prevention, outdoor time is more effective
appears to be the case.
You know, pre than post. And if nothing else, you know, the moment they cross the line, you can do something.
We can
with
do
them.
Something about them. Yeah.
And there were others also. The other thing I'm looking at the moment is the use of centile charts to see where kids are within a population, see if they're changing, because that's how when kids are growing.
That's fascinating, and that's got to be the next
clinical
frontier for us, because we understand what these growth charts are like for their height and for all other measures of pediatric growth, but we're yet to really achieve clear pictures of what that's like for the eye. And I think that could really revolutionise up the pre-myope and
because there is a bucket of large population-based observational cohorts.
Mm. So we need to merge it. Someone's got to merge them all together.
Well,
Ian, that sounds like a job for you.
I'm just doing something right now. the Garner Claver and Kathy Williams, who's involved the ASPEC consortium, pulled in some of the Rotterdam study and the UK data and some of the old European data. In relation to centile charts and where you are in the fractal spectrum, that's pretty easy to pull together. Couple of great European longitudinal cohorts, Catherine Saunders' nicer one, Cinemopia study. There are buckets of them there. So the data is available to convert that into a pretty predictable centile chart. Because they are longitudinal studies, you can tell who. Which part of the centile ended up becoming myopic. In terms of risk prediction.
So we should be doing pre-myopia as a thing. We have some interventions available. Your paper doesn't cover interventions. That's a whole extra paper altogether. But it's definitely something that we need to be able to detect, as you've said, to be able to look at the children who are likely to progress and end up with those higher levels of myopia and the higher associations with pathology.
Look, you don't need to believe in pre-myopia. If the parents are myopic, and the kids close to their kind of duty band just to monitor them closely.
Do that.
You can believe pre-myopia is complete rubbish.
Yeah.
Then once they become myopic,
then you can believe in it.
You never need to believe in it. But you know, if you just know the fact that, you know, some kids are at risk and accept the fact that, you know, young emmetropes might become myopic, and particularly the parents are myopic, you know.
That's the place to start.
Offer a monitoring.
Monitor them. Absolutely. And is there any sort of final key points or key take homes that you'd really like clinicians to take away from your paper, aside from reading it, because it's a brilliant read, and I think it's actually the shortest of the IMI papers, so it's brilliant and succinct. Done a very good job in that respect. So is there anything else that you'd like to convey to our listeners, particularly from the clinical point of view? So we've talked about understanding definitions, the importance of that from a study point of view, but also from a clinical point of view. We've talked about pre-myopia. We've talked about structural complications of myopia.
One request is in relation to the terminology. Let's just try to avoid all the modifying terms.
Physiologic, not a thing.
School correlational sort of
school age,
juvenile onsets, all these other terms, because European kids get myopic later, Chinese get myopic earlier. Are they different conditions? So just think very hard before you put any other word in front of myopia that's not high.
Yeah.
So it's either myopia, it's high myopia.
Yeah.
And if there's any other word, adjective in there,
you might be being creative.
Just take it out.
Yes.
If you really, really have to put it in for a really good reason, define it and justify it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a great place to finish. So thank you so much for your time, Ian. We need to get ourselves sorted now for this presentation. We've had bread rolls put in front of us so we can have a snack beforehand. So thank you very much, and I'll look forward to hearing more of what you've got to tell everyone tonight.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks.